Well, I think it. I will try it again. Thank you very much. Greetings to all of you tonight, and we hope your Sabbath was uplifting. Your week is going well. It's really good to be with all of you. Last week, Tuesday, we explored the background to Esther and explored, of course, Esther chapter 1. Tonight, we're going to continue in the inspiring book of Esther, chapters 2. And if things go well, we'll go all the way through chapter 3 as well. It's pretty inspiring, pretty encouraging. But before we do, let's open with prayer by Mr. Scott Thomas, who's a deacon here in Atlanta. Mr. Scott, please.
Please bow your heads. Father in heaven, we come before you this night so grateful to have the opportunity to study your word, to be taught your word, Father. Please help us to absorb every word that is given tonight so that we may enact it, Father. And Father, what an incredible example that we have before us in the book of Esther that basically tells us that you enact your will no matter who is in power, Father. And Father, please help us to take hold of that lesson. And Father, we are so grateful for your will and for your power and for your majesty for all of mankind, Father, and what you do for us and what your plan for mankind. Father, we thank you for everything that you do for us. Please be with those who need your help, Father. There are many that are grieving. We thank you for that comfort that you give us, Father. And Father, we ask you, please, just one last time to help us to absorb what is taught tonight and help us to enact it into our everyday lives. And we thank you. And we also ask you, please bless the teaching. And we thank you so much. And we commit this service, this Bible study into your hand in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much, Scott. Appreciate that. Okay, let me see here. I can reduce this picture. I think I'll be able to do it. I'm going to give a brief review of chapter 1 before we go into chapter 2 and 3. It addresses, there'll be some things I'll leave out, of course, King Ahasuerus. Or Xerxes, Xerxes, 3 years into his reign, who threw a great party. And in and during that party, he boasted to all his officials. It says his servants, his nobles, and his princes, rulers, 2,727 provinces. So there were a lot of rulers, apparently. And he did this incredibly for 180 days. And he talked about his fabulous reign, his riches, and its splendor. Has to do with the magnificence and grandeur of his great kingdom. And I put a parenthetical thought here. I wonder if anyone slept through that 180 days. That just seems almost impossible. Likely assumed by his assurance, assured brilliance, he threw another party. Following that, of all things, 180 days. You know, I had to think about those 180 days. What did he do? Did he take them around the city of Susa? I wouldn't think that he would take them to the far reaches of his far-reaching kingdom. But he had this second feast that he wanted to bring on, and it lasted 7 days. And on the seventh day, he was a little high, a little tipsy, or maybe drunk. He commanded the Queen Vashti would parade herself before the people and officials, for she was a beauty to behold, the scripture says. The queen refused the king's command, and to her surprise, I would think she would be surprised, she was removed from being queen. With advice, they told him, let her go, don't let her be queen anymore. And here are some steps that you can follow to replace her. So this began God's plan to bring Esther into the palace so she would have the opportunity as queen to help save her people. And this led to God saving the Jews scattered throughout 127 provinces. Now, you will find, if you do a bit of research on this, that some researchers argue that, well, there were a certain number of satrapies anywhere from 24 to 28, maybe more. And that certainly wouldn't add up to 127. But each one of those satrapies had a certain number of provinces. So the provinces themselves added up to 127, very large kingdom. And so she became queen and could help save her people. This led to God saving the Jews through Mordecai and Esther. Esther is a classic beauty of her own. She was very wise, she was patient, and she was service oriented. So we are going to enter chapter two. I think it's she was probably pretty young. I don't know if she was 20 years of age by this time, but who knows? It doesn't tell us precisely. And she could have been a little younger, could be at least 18 to 20 or a little bit older. Not going to get into that. Don't have a dog in the fight on this one. So we'll get into chapter two now and verse one. Note, here's a notice that I want to bring to your attention once again. God's name, of course, is not mentioned in Esther, but his protection, his faithfulness to his saints, and his deliverance of them are clearly seen throughout this historical book of God saving the Jews in Persia. It must be noted that those weren't all the Jews in the Middle East, but there were certainly a considerable number in Persia. Later on, when King Cyrus allowed, or however, whichever time this came about, allowed the Jews to go back with Nehemiah and eventually Ezra setting up the litany of the services in the temple and whatever was necessary there. There were some 49,000 Jews who actually went to Jerusalem. Not all of the Jews went. So I think there was probably a significant number of Jews in and throughout Persia. So it helped pave the way, God doing what he did to save the Jews, for Nehemiah and Ezra, and elevated Mordecai to be second in power under the king of Persia. So I just wanted to bring that as a little bit of a note, a side note that might want to keep in mind. So let's begin in chapter 2 and verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, his wife, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Of course, he was very angry. A king in that position, especially a Gentile king, was pretty narcissistic. He liked himself a lot, and whatever he said went. You couldn't gainsay it. You couldn't stop it. You couldn't turn it over. If he wrote something and then sealed it with his signet ring, that was the law of the Medes and the Persians, and it could not be reversed. So he knew he had a lot of power. But all of a sudden, he suddenly remembered Vashti. Now, it is also true, and although I don't think I've mentioned this before, Gentile kings had concubines, to be sure. But here it shows that he remembered Vashti and what she had done, how she had insulted him and made him look the fool, and what he had decreed against her. And of course, he couldn't reverse it. So the servants around him knew what he was thinking about, what he was probably talking about it, probably grumbling about it, upset about it. So the king's servants in verse 2, who attended him, so they had to be really close to him and knew what was going on, they said to him, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king." I think that's interesting that they use the term virgins. So that shows where his attitude was and what his frame of mind, how he thought of morals and values. "And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan," which is Susa, Susa, a city of Babylon, but it was taken over, of course, by the Persians. And it was the citadel, it was a palace there, and it was known for, I think legal things. I've forgotten exactly all that it was noted for. And there was more than one capital, so to speak. And to call them and place them into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai. I know that's spelled Hegai. I looked it up and they pronounced it Hey Gay E, Hegai, the king's eunuch. So if he were a real eunuch and a true eunuch, then he was no longer a man, and they weren't going to take any chances for a man to be around all the concubines and all the young women. He was custodian of the women, and he let beauty preparations be given to all of them, because the word went out to all of the areas to bring the young virgins to before the king. And they didn't just bring them right immediately before the king. They had to prepare them and make them look even more beautiful. And I think it was like 6 months for a certain thing. They had to do another 6 months. I don't know. They look at time differently than we do in this day and age. Then let the young woman, verse 4, singular, who pleases a king, be queen instead of Vashti. So they were aware, well aware, he must be well aware of the fact that he kept talking about Queen Vashti or about Vashti. And this thing that they said to him in their advice and trying to please him and encourage him, please the king. And he did so. He said, that's just fine. We will go through that. Now, in verse 5, in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew. This is Esther 2 5. There was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, and it gives his ancestry not too far back, but far enough. The son of Jair, Jair, the son of Shimei, and the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So Kish may have been of royalty, and we'll get to that here in just a moment. He was a Benjamite. If you do see the, if you look into the history of the split up of the northern kingdom, the so-called lost 10 tribes of Israel, the northern kingdom, under Jeroboam, who rebelled, and Rehoboam was the king of Judah, that was the southern kingdom. Well, the Benjamites went with the Jews, the tribe of Judah, also the Levites as well. Might have been a few Simeonites here and there, as I recall in my ambassador college days when we were taught these things. But I think it's interesting, and Kish may have been royalty. And the reason I say that is for the next verse. Kish, that's italicized, but that's who the writer's talking about. And I happen to think it's Mordecai who wrote this, for the most part, had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with King Jeconiah of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, this goes back to the Babylonian captivity. They first hit him in about 605 BC, 597, when the Jews said, we're not going to take this any longer. And finally, 587, where he razed, R-A-Z-E-D, I think the temple and other important buildings as well. And he said, I'm not going to put up with this any longer. But I want to go back here because Nebuchadnezzar, no dummy, he actually took the king and he took royal people with him. And Daniel very likely was of a royal blood, and he was with them as well as others. The king did that because he knew that they had been well educated and knew how to conduct themselves, knew how to think, knew how to work things out. And they were pretty smart individuals. So he took them with him to Babylon. And that's why I think Kish may indeed have been of royal blood. Maybe not directly, but who knows, cousin, nephew, whatever, in those days. And Mordecai, verse 7, had brought up Hadassah. See if I can get this thing here to work. Here we go. Hadassah, which means in the Hebrew language, it means myrtle, which has to do with peace. So he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, is her Persian name, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. So they were cousins. And of course, I think I mentioned this earlier because I think I went through this last time, went through it quickly, that he was much older than Esther was, or Hadassah was. And after she lost her mom and dad, as an older cousin to a younger cousin, he stepped in and he took care of her, just as if he were her father. The young woman, to continue in verse 7, was lovely and beautiful. And when her father and mother died, as I mentioned, indicated, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he's pretty jealous of her, and he wanted to protect her and do whatever he could to keep her safe and to watch out for her in every way, probably teach her the will of God, the way of God, as he knew it. Verse 8, so it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered to Susa, or Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Hegai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of, I keep wanting to call him Hegai, but I'll call him Hegai, the custodian of the women, plural. The women. So there was a place for them to be brought together. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, the custodian of the women, that is Hegai, pleased him, the way she looked, the way she handled herself, the way she conducted herself, and she obtained his favor. And he played a favorite there. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides that which was allowed for all of them to be given. So it was a step up, is one and a half times, so to speak. Then seven choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace. And he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Well, that harkens back to the fact that she obtained his favor, and she was pretty impressive. And he assigned seven choice maidservants to take care of her. Esther had not revealed her. It's kind of an inset here. In verse 10, Esther, parenthetically insert here, had not revealed her people, the Jews, or her family. For Mordecai, who is much older and wiser, and who had served in and around the palace, knew the attitude of the Persians, knew how they thought, their culture, knew about their values, knew how the king operated, and what could be expected of the king and the queen. So he told her not to reveal the fact that she was a Jewess, verse 11. And every day, to show that he was a very jealous, father-like figure, her older, much older cousin, paced in front of the court of the women's quarters. That tells me that Mordecai had a pretty important position there, to be able to be inside the palace area. Because he wanted to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Suggests to me, if you were watching this on the in a movie, that he probably stopped people that he knew and he could trust and ask, "Do you know anything about Esther? Do you know anything about how what these women are doing and what's going on?" And he was pacing back and forth. Verse 12, each young woman's turn came, as was to be expected, to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed, notice this, 12 months preparation. Boy, they took their time, didn't they? According to the regulations for the women. They sound more German than the Germans. according to the regulations of the women. For thus were the days of their preparation for the women, and for thus were the, I said that, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying the women. So they had quite a thing that they had to go through, quite a standard that was set for them. And the king had to approve that, of course, before this time, certainly. And they were just following his orders, following his standard and what was required. It also suggests to me, this is not the first time that they brought young women in and prepared them to be with the king as he might want. Verse 13, thus prepared, young women went to the king. This is a year later. And she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. Remember that Haggai was really impressed with her. So he gave her the option, take what you want, don't take what you don't want. You can do whatever you want, whatever you desire to take, that's good with me. Verse 14, in the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women to the custody of I didn't look this one up. It's got every letter in the alphabet. Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Wow, talk about rigor. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, for her to go into the king before the king to present herself, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So it was like parading before these people to say, hey, what do you think? Do you like what you see? Is she doing well? So on. Is she dressed nicely? Does her dress fit her well? Her hair, the whole bit. And she obtained favor in the sight of all those women who saw her, the young women. Verse 16, now it's the time for her to be presented before the king. He is the second great Gentile king, so to speak, or the second great Gentile kingdom of Persia, Medo-Persian Empire. Eventually, the Medes were kind of swallowed up. The Persians, they took over. You can see that as we heard Dr. Phil in Daniel chapter 8, having to do with the horns on the Medo-Persian Empire. And the Persians took over. So this is where we are. And Esther was taken before the king, Ahasuerus, into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is a month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So that suggests to me, again, that Mordecai had something to do with writing up Esther. I think it's pretty important. You'll have all kinds of researchers, theologians, whomever looked into this, whatever commentary you might read, they differ. And they will say, no, it probably wasn't Mordecai, it was someone else, might have been the great assembly, which included a number of prophets, some of the minor prophets. Daniel would be included. He wasn't a minor prophet. And others over a period of time, they called that the great assembly. They were the editors. They're the ones that determined what should be canonized, so to speak. I was taught in Ambassador College that Ezra had a great deal to do with the Old Testament. I'm not going to argue that right now, but at least you can see that a lot of them did this. I think Mordecai knew enough about the culture of Persia to be able to talk about the Persian Empire, talk about the king and how they conducted, how he would conduct himself. There is a record, I think, in the Persian annals, whatever they call them, where this Marduka is mentioned, and some think that was a Persian name for Mordecai, who had something to, he was significant in the Persian Empire at his time. So Esther was taken 16 to King Ahasuerus, shows the exact time. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and a lot of them paraded before him. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set, talk about emotion ruling over logic. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. That's a shortened version here, probably what took place. But I mean, that had to be pretty impressive for this to take place, to actually set the royal crown upon her head and to actually make her queen of Persia. 127 provinces, very large territory, great territory. Second, a great Gentile kingdom. First one's Babylon, second, Persia. Third, Greece, fourth, Roman, you know that. Then, verse 18, the king made a great feast. He could do that. He didn't have to go to the kitchen and cook things up. He wasn't a chef. He had people to do that. All he had to do was give the instruction, the order. And he made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and all of his servants. It's interesting. You'll see the word officials, you'll see the word princes, you'll see other words, you'll see servants. I would say that the officials probably had a little bit more greater credentials than the servants themselves, but they all had access to the king to some degree. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces, all of them, and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. Well, it doesn't say whom he gave gifts to, but my guess is whoever was around, maybe the officials, maybe the servants, certainly to Esther, his new queen, according to the generosity of a king. So apparently, the writer of this happened to be Mordecai. He would understand what kings did and how they had the power to be able to do this and had the wherewithal to do this. Of course, these kings didn't just take anything from their properties. They had conquered so many of the territories, they would bring home gold, silver, you name it. They'd bring it home and they put it in their own treasury. And so he could give gifts. They weren't all coming from his own chest of treasury or chest of goods, treasury of goods, but those were things that he had acquired and others before him had acquired as well. So he gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. He could be generous. Verse 19, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. To be able to sit within the king's gate meant that you were somebody. You were trusted. And you had the opportunity to be able to advise and to help others who might come to the gate and ask for help. Now, Esther had not revealed, verse 20, her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. So, however young she was, until the time that we come to this, he had taught her a great deal. And he was really looking out for her, taking care of her. In those days, verse 21, while Mordecai, see if I can get my mouse to work here. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, again, here's where knowledge could be found, could be had. What's happening inside the palace? What's happening with the king? What's going on? They talked about such things, and some of them would, of course, pass along the information that they knew. While Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, it names them here, Bigthan and Teresh. They were doorkeepers. They became angry, furious, And they sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. That's just a nice way of saying, we're going to kill him. We're going to take his life. So the matter, verse 22, became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, so he had access to Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Boy, there's a lot going on there. So he was able to have access to Queen Esther, his first cousin, and then Esther had the opportunity to go to the king. Usually you didn't go on your own and just walk up and say, hey, I want a little time with you, king. He had to put forth his staff, and that would allow them to come in. If they entered and he didn't suggest them, they died. That simple. So Esther was able to inform the king about Bigthan and Teresh and how they were plotting to assassinate the king. And she said, this is Mordecai who let me know this. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, whether this was true, whether they went to Mordecai and asked him directly, don't know, it doesn't say. But they did inquire about it. They did ask questions. And it was confirmed that they had that in mind, these two men, these two doorkeepers. Both of them were hanged on a gallows. And it was written what happened, what took place, including Mordecai going to Esther about this. That also was written, we'll see this later, in the book of the Chronicles. That's the king's chronicles of all Persia, in the presence of the king. Wow, that's doing something here. So they were very thorough as to what they did. Let's go to chapter 3. And unless we have any questions here, if not, we'll continue. Do you know, Dr. Phil, whether we have any?
Yeah, I just have one right now.
Okay.
And give me 1 second.
No problem.
The question comes from Michael Crishlow. How could Mordecai be a Jew and his father, Kish, a Benjamite?
Oh, very good question. Yeah, you do a little bit of historical research on this, and you find out, of course, it'd have to be historical. And you would find that when Jeroboam rebelled and say, okay, let's go to the 10 tribes, whoever would follow him, and 10 tribes did follow him, they split. Rehoboam remained, of course, king over Judah. Israel retained the name of Israel, that is the 10 nations. I'm still going to get to your point. And Judah was the main tribe of the southern kingdom. But Benjamin, who had some points of contention with Judah earlier on, made up with him, with Judah, and they went with Judah. So Benjamin could be, they weren't Jewish, they were Benjamites. Incidentally, the Benjamites were fierce fighters in war. And they were very good with the sling, extremely good. And they were fighters, they were fearless. And they went with Judah, as well as, I'm still going to answer the question, I'm in the process of answering it. And they also had the Levites who remained in Jerusalem and under Judah, and the kings of Judah, of course. And so Benjamin was considered to be part of the nation or the southern kingdom of Judah. So they would view the Benjamites who linked up with, who shoulder to shoulder with the Jews, they also viewed them, in a sense, not knowing they were Gentiles, as Jews. They weren't Jews. They were Benjamites. And if you remember, Paul, if you read about Paul, you might think that Paul was a Jew, and he admits very clearly that he was a Benjamite, if you remember that in the New Testament in one of his letters. So this Benjamite would be considered, he wasn't Jewish, Kish. He was a Benjamite. But as far as the Gentiles were concerned, he was Jewish. And so they just assume that responsibility. They just assume that tribe in a greater sense. They knew there were Benjamites as part of the kingdom of Judah. People around them would consider them to be Jews, the Benjamites. So I hope that answers it as close as we can get to it.
I believe so. The other question I had, and I went to see my Bible. Do we have by estimates how old the virgins would have been who were rounded up for the king? Do we have any idea how old? Have you heard a number in regard to how old Esther would have been?
No, I did not. I haven't read that yet. Now, it is during that particular time. I don't think they lived as long as we do today. It could be wrong. David did say that I think he lived to be 70, and anything greater than that is a blessing. So I think it was possible that these young virgins might have been teenagers, might have been 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, but I didn't see anywhere in any of the research I've done that what Esther's age was. Personally, I'd think she'd be older than 16 or 17. I think she'd be closer to 20, but that's guesswork. That's as close as I can get to it. And of course, things were different then than they are today.
Yeah.
In terms of people getting married and in terms of young women presenting themselves, those young women didn't have much of a choice.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how young they were. I don't think they were 12 and 13 or 14
mm-hmm.
or even 15. I think they were older than that.
So I had seen about the same. I'd seen mid-teens to 20.
Yeah.
On a number of commentaries while you were going.
Good. I'm glad that you did. I would agree with that. They were very young.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Go ahead.
Forgive me. I was going to say we don't have any more questions. I didn't mean to cut you off.
All right. So we can move on to chapter 3. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Here we got a guy by the name of Haman who comes into the scene, into the picture. The son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Wow, that's quite a name. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So he was over all the, it's kind of like a prime minister, not the king, didn't have the power of the king. I think it's interesting that the writer here in Esther identifies him as an Agagite, which means that he was an Amalekite. Which also means when you do a little bit of research, that it was the Amalekites who would not allow the Israelites to come into, they were ready to kill all of the Israelites when they were going to enter into the promised land. If they had come by the interstate, the freeway, the road to Palestine, they were ready to kill them. What's also said, if you look into the and do a little bit of research on them, you'll find the Amalekites were kind of like coyotes. They went around and they'd get the people who dragged along the latter end of the group of Israel and the children and everything, and he'd kill them. They were mean. I heard a sermonette, what his name is, who gave a really good sermonette about how the Amalekites are related to the modern day Hamas group today. I thought that was interesting. And having heard what he had to say, of course, what are you going to be able to prove in 15 minutes? But it sure made good sense. And of course, God has something to say about the Amalekites. And he was ready to wipe them out. So now I'm back here to the Haman, who was an Agagite, who is a ruler of the Amalekites. And Haman was advanced, and he was set above all the princes and all the king's servants in verse 2, who were within the king's gate. Hey, again, they had a little bit of prestige. They weren't the ordinary person who couldn't come into the gates. They were within the king's gate. They bowed, which prostrated themselves concerning him, rather paid homage to Haman, which is to say, they bowed and treated him as a god, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage to Haman, because that went against what the Jews were supposed to do. Only God is king. They would only bow to him. They wouldn't bow to another human being. Haman didn't know this right away. We're going to see this. Then the king's servants, verse 3, who were within the king's gate again, said to Mordecai. So they saw what was going on. And if they had what, 15, 20, 30 servants here, and Haman came by in his carriage, and they were all bowing down to the ground, face down, belly to the ground, so to speak. And they were honoring him like as if he were a god. Who were within the king's gate, they addressed this to Mordecai. They noticed that Mordecai did not do that. Why do you transgress? Why do you break the king's command? Verse 4. Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and so they kept asking him, why are you not bowing? What strikes me is, how did that miss the observation of Haman? Wow, how come he didn't see that? Well, about the only thing I can think of is that Mordecai was somewhere within the whole group, and all he saw probably was a bunch of men who bowed down and worshiped him. And that was good enough for him. And he's probably so proud of himself. He thought everybody did it, not realizing that one did not. That would be Mordecai. And they didn't like that. They thought, hey, we're doing it. Why aren't you doing it? Now, it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. Here we go in the latter part of verse 4. Here it comes out. For Mordecai had told him the reason, and the reason was, he said, he was a Jew. He would not do that. He was from the tribe of Judah. I know he's a Benjamite. He was from the tribe of Judah. He was a Jew. When Haman then saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was angry. He was filled with anger. How dare you not bow down? The king told you to do it. That was the law, and you didn't do it. Who do you think you are? But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Who would that be? It'd be fellow Jews. There likely were other Jews around, and he knew it in the city, this capital city of Susa. So he thought, I can't do that. I want to do it, but I can't do it. Instead, middle part of verse 6, Haman then contrived this plan. He sought to destroy all of the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, all those people of Mordecai, the Jews. He thought, well, I won't just get him, I'll get everybody. I'll wipe all of the Jews out from the kingdom. Now I've got to work this plan out. In the first month, verse 7, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. This is interesting to use Nisan. I should go to my notes here in verse 7. I think I wrote this down. Nisan is the month, the first month of the year, 14th and the 15th, 14th of Nisan, Passover that we keep. In the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. So that suggests to me that Mordecai had a hand in this. How else, if it were a Gentile who wrote this, how would they know this? And if they did, would they add it to this book of Esther? In the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, and Pur is a lot from which we get Purim, comes later on. Before Haman, They cast pur, a lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. I got a feeling I'm not even close to my notes in chapter 3, so bear with me for a moment so I can get my inspired margins here. Oh, I had more about the Amalekites. I won't go back to that. So on Nisan, the first day of God's calendar when Passover celebrated, Adar is a month before Nisan. That's March, April, when the Feast of Purim is kept, commemorating God's delivering the Jews in Persia. I'm getting ahead. I'm doing a little quantum leap here. Just giving you an idea on Adar, A-D-A-R, as we find it here in verse 7. Verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus. So he had to be able to have access to the king without too much trouble. There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all of the peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to allow them to let them remain. Boy, that's a mouthful. You remember how they set up Daniel? These different groups, the counselors of the king, and set him up so that he would be trapped. And this is what's happened again. What I'm saying is that Satan and the demons are behind all of this. God allows the Satan and the demons to do certain things. In one place in the Old Testament, God allowed a lying spirit, I think it was to go to King Saul. I'm not sure exactly about that because I'm just doing that from memory. So God allows Satan and the demons to do certain things. They can't do anything that he won't let them do. Here again, we find that Haman is doing something that those counselors did with Nebuchadnezzar. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written. I'm amazed how they introduce this. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, killed, murdered, and massacred. I'm using those terms. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work, to bring it into the king's treasuries. That's interesting. That sounds like a contradiction. He's not just paying those who are going to do the dirty work, but then all that money is going to be brought into the king's treasuries. That's what it sounds like. I haven't done enough research to go any further than that on, but I think it's odd the way he put that. But then again, he was a mean and nasty dude. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and he gave it to Haman. Wow, that's doing something. He didn't just hold on to it and use the signet himself to seal something, a law of the Medes and the Persians. He actually gave it to Haman. And of course, he's the son of this guy with all the letters of the alphabet in his name, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as it seems good to you. The king knew what he offered. Now the king is saying, I'm giving it all to you. It's all in your hands. Do what you want to do. He promoted him. Haman had been very political, got himself into position, thought, hey, I've got the corner on the market here. I might even become king. Who knows? Then the king's scribes, verse 12, were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded. To the king's satraps, of course, all the provinces were under these satraps, to the governors who were over each province, that'd be 127, to the officials of all people, to, I would say they were sheriffs, whatever they might be called, that would be equal to our magistrates today, to every province according to its script, which is to say in its language, so that those people would understand in all these different and varied cultures and languages of the peoples in these 127 provinces. They weren't all Persians. They weren't all Medes. They had brought a lot of these people that they conquered back into Persia. And this is why they, to give it in every province according to its script and to every people in their language, kind of doubling up and doubling down here to make sure we don't understand. Don't misunderstand. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. They usually had some red wax or whatever it was. The king would put his signet ring on it, and that was the imprint, and that showed that came from the king. You dare not break the envelope. You dare not break that seal. And the letters were sent by couriers. So, boy, they got all hurried up about this. By couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, notice both young and old, little children and women, in one day. That's a lot of letting of blood. On the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions, to take whatever they have, whatever they've accrued over the years. If they were farmers, whatever they did, they'd take all of the properties that were worth something. Plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, and that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out and they hurried because of the king's command. He said, let's get this done immediately. And the decree was proclaimed in Susa, Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. How can you do that? But the city of Susa was troubled by all of this. And I looked up the word perplexed here, and it's talking about being very troubled, being confused, not understanding what was going on. Because there were also Jews throughout the city of Susa, to be sure. So we've gone through the last verse of Esther chapter 3, verse 15. We still have 7 minutes. You want me to go on to 4? Or do you have questions or thoughts or comments? Anyone?
Forgive me, I was having a hard time getting the microphone open. There are not questions on here right now.
Okay, all right.
I'll share what I put in the chat room column for those who happen to be paying attention. One is, I put the commentary for Esther 2 up. I put the commentary for Esther 3 up, the UCB commentary. I also went back and found that verse for Samuel 22:22, where you talked about Samuel being troubled. Is that right? With an evil spirit?
I thought it was Saul.
It was Saul. Well, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
I just didn't say that.
It's in the book of Samuel. I'm reading it.
That's right.
1 Samuel 22:22.
Yeah, God was not happy with Saul.
Yeah. But unless, and I tell you what we can do is open invitation. Anyone can put a question in there now.
Sure.
And if you want to preview chapter 3.
We've done 3.
I'm sorry, 4. What am
yes.
I saying? I'm
not
having a hard time tonight.
No, you're fine. Well, yeah, I could do a little bit of that while if questions are being formed or shaped in any way, thoughts, commentary, whatever.
Yeah, I'll ask one question.
Sure.
And this goes back to the section of Revelation that you made mention of some time ago, where we had shared the sermon, you'd shared the sermon on Revelation, the Book of Life.
Yes.
And its parallel or its connection with Numbers. I'm going back a chapter. Have you ever heard anything, or has anyone ever drawn a connection with the book of Mordecai? Mordecai is written in the Book of the Chronicles in chapter 223.
Hold on, let me go back to there.
and the Book of Life? Or is that, are we making a
Where do you
stretch
find
there?
this? What,
Esther
verse 23?
2:23.
Oh, 223, yeah. Those chronicles are the King's Chronicles.
Right.
Because we see later on that the king couldn't sleep, so he asked to see the chronicles. He wanted to read them.
Right.
But I'm getting ahead of myself there.
Yeah.
And he found out what happened and how Mordecai, this is God working things out beautifully. He catches the wicked in their own craftiness, wherever that scripture is. I know I read it somewhere. It had to be in Proverbs or no, it was in Job, as I recall. Anyway, where God is setting this up, and then later on he couldn't sleep. Well, I think God had a hand in that, and so he asked him to bring the chronicles so he could reread them. And when he did read, he read about Bigthan and Teresh and what they had done and who had revealed that assassination attempt. It was Mordecai. Only he did not say to Haman who it was. He just said, "What do you think should be done to this guy who did a great thing and saved my life?"
Yeah.
But I'm ahead.
Yeah.
That's the Chronicles.
Gotcha. I just went and looked. The marginal reference listed 6:1 and 10:2. So it's referenced twice more, even as we go through the book. I was curious,
Six
but
one.
yeah.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. In 10:2.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
So I
What
noted
really
that.
what amazes me, and I think it's really good. They pretty well quantified everything. They didn't just leave it to guesswork. They wrote everything down, had great records.
Yeah. So if you want to take the next 10, 12 minutes and hit,
Sure.
what are we
I can
at?
go through here kind of
Four?
quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. And that's symbolic of repenting, being sad, being sorry, and repenting before God in the sense of laying yourself out before God and saying, "This is terrible. You've got to help us. This is terrible." And he went out into the midst of the city and he cried out with a loud and a bitter cry. That is phenomenal that he went out there and did this. And of course, the Jews were very, very good soldiers. And whenever God sent them, the tribes of Israel, out to do battle, guess who led the army? The Jews. Judah was the head tribe. So I'm taking that to show that they were out there, they were up front, and Mordecai was just up front with his feelings and his thoughts. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. There are people who knew him, and they heard him cry aloud with a bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. So he couldn't go in. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning. Now we're linking what Mordecai did with all the other the Jews in these many different provinces who were crying out among the Jews. And they fasted, they wept, they cried, they wailed, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. That's a study all of itself, to follow through with sackcloth and ashes. It's interesting. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her. And the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, take his sackcloth away from him. But he wouldn't accept them. He was laying himself out there before God. And in a sense, he did what Esther said she was going to do. If I die, I die. He had to just reveal himself entirely and let them know how anxious he was and how terrible this was. And he refused the clothes that would be nice clothes for him to be able to come into the king's gate. Then Esther called, well, this is another name here. HAT, did I pass that up? Yeah. Hathach or Hathach. I'm probably not saying it right, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her. The king had given this person to watch out for her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai, just to learn what and why this was. She didn't know. So Hathach, or Hathach, or Thathach, whatever it is, went out to Mordecai. I should have looked it up, in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that happened to him, and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. There you again, you find out that Mordecai had inside information. So he was not just your local yokel. He wasn't just someone out there digging ditches. He had an important position, and he could let this guy know, this eunuch know, what was taking place. Mordecai told him what happened, the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay, 10,000 talents. Should have looked that up. I don't know what that would equate to today, but it'd be considerable. Into the king's treasuries to destroy, I underscore the word destroy, the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction. Get a hold of that, which was given at Shushan, or throughout Susa, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. Now, for him to say that in verse 8, for him to say that, the emotion was riding a little bit ahead of logic, because she couldn't just go into the king without him inviting her. But he said, this is it. Everything's on the line. We got to do anything we can do to turn this around. Plead to the king for her people. So Hathach, or Hathach, returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. Esther, the same Esther that Mordecai had trained, Mordecai had taught, Mordecai had educated. This is incredible. She's now saying all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, something I've alluded to, he has but one law, the Medes and the Persians, can't reverse it, put all to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he or she, I'm adding, may live. Yet I myself, I haven't been called to go into the king for 30 days. What is this guy doing? What is this king doing for 30 days? So without the queen being before him. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows? Oh, this is a quintessential sort of rhetorical question. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Rhetorically is saying, this is what I believe God, why he has placed you where you are. This is vitally important. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. Still listening to Mordecai, love it. Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Susa. Fast for me. Don't eat, don't drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. If I die, I die. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Boy, they had a very close relationship, and she had great respect for Mordecai, and she believed in God. Mordecai had taught her, God is everything. God can save you in tough times, difficult times. He can turn everything around for you when it's the most dangerous time of your life. He can turn things around. You got to believe that. You got to believe that what God promises to do, he will do. And so this is her attitude. She knew, she remembered what Mordecai had taught her over those years. And she says, if I die, I die. What a woman. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Okay, I'm a little bit over. I'm at 8:05 by my clock. I think it's 8:06. So do we go to 5 or do we have questions?
I don't see any other questions come up.
Okay. If we like the story, we can move on. Or wait.
Sure. No, I mean, we can go another,
five
or
ten
so minutes? Yeah,
okay.
And then you could finish the chapter if you wanted.
Now it happened. Okay.
I'll leave it to you.
Yeah, I'll go about 5 or no more than, to 10 after 15. I won't go beyond 15 after. Now, it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes, which is very smart. Again, she's a very wise lady. And she stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. Now, it's not like our houses today where you have walls and you with doors and so on. Now, these wide openings and a beautiful layout of this palace. So you can see quite a way. So it was when the king saw King Esther standing in the court, very wise. She was in the inner court. She wasn't before the royal throne in the royal house. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. It's like him thinking, wow, who is that beautiful woman? That must be my wife. I can't believe it. Haven't seen her for 30 days. And the king held out to Esther. Didn't take him long, did it? The golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched, as she should, as the law required, the top of the scepter. I did some research on that. I've forgotten now what years ago. Sorry about that. That's important. And the king said to her, listen to this. This is beautiful. What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? So his head is spinning. Eyeballs are spinning. And he's breathing a little bit faster than he would ordinarily. He said, it shall be given to you. You ready for this? Up to half the kingdom. Who's going to give away half the kingdom for anyone else? So this Esther must have been stunning. So Esther answered. She didn't tell him straight up what was going on. If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I have prepared for him. She could have said, okay, all right, if you insist, I'll take half the kingdom. She said, instead, I want to present a banquet. I want to provide a banquet that I prepared for the king and Haman. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, well, we're jumping right in the middle of this. This is heavy duty. The king said to Esther, what is your petition? Here he's going to repeat himself. It shall be granted you. This time he says it in front of Haman. What is your request up to half the kingdom? It shall be done. That's absolutely remarkable. Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this: if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them." I thought it was ready. I was ahead of myself. "I will prepare for them," which is the wise thing to do, "and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So Haman went out that day. Oh, he was kicking up his heels, if he had heels, that day, joyful and with a glad heart. Oh, he was happy. He says, "I can't believe this." But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, and he went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. So there was this little sting, this little thorn in the side of Haman when he saw Mordecai, who would not stand or tremble before him. So he thought, "Well, I'm going to go home. I'm going to see my wife. I'm going to call my friends together." Haman told them of his great riches in verse 11. The multitude of his children told them his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. I'm amazed that hadn't gotten to them earlier. Moreover, Haman said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Well, there's an antidote to this. We can take care of this. Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high so everybody could see it. And in the morning, suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. And then go merrily with the king to the banquet." And that thing pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. Big mistake. Okay, we won't go any further. It's 8:15. Is it 8:15? 13. What do you want to do now? Do you have any questions or comments?
It is. No questions, no comments. Right there. Okay. I've listed commentary, and we could call it here, and you leave us cliffhanging until next week.
Well, we can do that.
Okay.
That would be good. So the best is yet to come.
Yep.
All right. Well, no questions, no comments, no thoughts at all from anyone?
It must have worked.
I can't believe how...
Alan Edge. Yes.
Yeah. I just want to say hi, Gerald.
Yes.
Yes.
Who is this?
It's Alan from Australia.
Oh, hi, Alan.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Did you have some thoughts about this? Early. I didn't know you were online.
Yes. Well, it's hard for me because it's like, to do these Bible studies is 7 o'clock in the morning for me.
Oh, my dear. Yeah.
So
I hadn't thought about that. My bad.
Yes.
So you're doing all right.
Yeah. So, my thought about Esther is like, I think I was meant to come on this morning because it gave me an idea for a sermonette for the feast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
what? You mean about Esther?
Yeah, it's an example of God's will being done, no matter who's in charge.
That's good.
And then relating it to the present times and into the millennium.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. As far as I'm concerned, I see God, because we have a pattern of how God works throughout the Bible. I see God ending up as he began, in the sense of providing miracles in the very end time. I think that's going to take place because that's how God has done things before. If you look at the the kingdom of the Jews, the kingdom of the southern kingdom, kingdom of Israel. Of course, they were taken in by Assyria, and Babylon came in and took Judah away. But in other instances, the pattern is that when God starts something, like he did the New Testament church, there were a lot of miracles. I think it's quite possible that God will have a lot of miracles toward the end, perhaps right before the Great Tribulation, and even throughout the Great Tribulation, there could be miracles that take place.
Well, one of them will be the protection of his people.
That's exactly right. And the
Yeah.
sealing of the 144,000. And
Yes.
you're right. And the protection of his people, very important in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. And that fits with the attitude of the Philadelphian.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important. You're right. Miracles are going to take place. I like that when you fit that together, Revelation 3:10 with Revelation chapter 12 toward the end of the chapter, and God is going to save his people. You can see this play out in Revelation 12 as to God trying to, excuse me, the God of this world, Satan the devil, is going to try and kill those that are going to be spared the great tribulation and taken to a place of safety. And again, great miracles are going to take place. That's how God works. It's a beautiful thing, should be encouraging to us.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So, well,
Yeah.
so where are you going to the feast?
Well, I'm going to stay local this year in Western Australia,
So that would be Perth.
mainly because my brother, Tony Edge, who's a pastor, is the coordinator for the feast, so I'll get to spend time with him.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That.
Last year I was in Albury Wodonga, which was a new site, and no, this year I'll stay in Rockingham.
And how many do you have there?
Well, we usually average about 80,
Good.
but this year we could be down on numbers because for some reason the brethren have decided to go support Penang in
Why?
Malaysia.
How many are they expecting in Penang?
Nearly 100 at the moment, and they've got room for another 50.
Wow.
So Grant Chick, if I remember right, is taking care of it.
Where
Yeah,
is
he's going to be
Penang?
hands full. It's just off, I think it's sort of just off the coast, or it's like a an extension of the coast of Malaysia.
Oh, okay. Now I
You have to
gotcha.
take a small flight or something to get there. But it's a big resort area for Malaysia.
Wow.
They've got these, fantastic hotels and resort features there. And Grant has been able to secure one of them for the feast.
Great.
So yeah, the brethren up there are I don't get to see anybody very often. So there's a few from Perth that go there every year to support them.
Super. That is good.
Yeah.
As we get
Yeah, we've
closer to
just
the end, yeah.
yeah, it's good for them. It's good encouragement, and plus, they all get to spend time with their friends, the brethren up there. And we've just heard that the Kuala Lumpur has a new congregation been added.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
Well,
Grant's
you
really got his hands full now.
I bet he would. I think I got to see him at the General Conference of Elders in May. That's amazing. Well,
He said, so we'll see him this week, but after that we won't see him for a month. That's how busy he is.
so does
So,
who do you say pastors Perth?
Grant Chick.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Grant. I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
I wasn't he
So
in
now he's got,
go ahead.
sorry, he's now he's got Kuala Lumpur. He's got Singapore, which he goes up about once every couple of months.
Wow.
And yeah, so he's got about four congregations nearly now.
Wow. Well, he has his hands full.
Oh yeah, a lot of traveling. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's,
That,
when you're in a big country like Australia, that's what happens.
yeah, that's right. I guess so. I've never been there.
Well, the door is open wide for anyone who wants to come.
It helps, Alan, I put in the chat room a connection to that fee site. And I went and checked. You're
Yeah.
right. They're right at 50 or so spots open.
Yeah.
That is amazing. I wonder if there are Americans who know that.
Some do now.
Yeah. Yeah, they do now.
Certainly through
Yeah.
this Bible study, they would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is
Well,
amazing.
the thing about down here is like the exchange rate is very much in American favor.
Oh.
So it's not like when I come to America, I lose money. When you come to Australia, you gain money.
I gotcha.
So if you say you have $1,000 American, it's worth about 1,300 to 1,400
Ooh.
Australian. So you got more spending money.
Yeah, you
Yeah.
would. That is really
So yeah.
incredible.
So I know
So,
Philip has said, he said to me a few times that he's always wanted to come to Australia.
Philip's been to
So
Australia.
it's been a few years. Melbourne,
yeah.
1990 for a month.
Yeah. So I'm going to keep encouraging him to come.
I hear you.
It's that
Once we
long
could do
trip,
some,
that long flight, man.
it is, yeah. But I've done it about, well, I've done it six times coming to America, to the Northern Hemisphere, and so six
Yeah.
times coming back. So I've crossed that ocean a few times.
I bet you have.
Yeah, it is tiring, but
Do you break up
yeah,
your
but it's
trip?
worth it.
Did you break, do you
No,
pick
oh
up the
well,
trip?
the last time, yeah, I did because I had the wife with me then, and she needed a break, so we stayed in Sydney for a night, and then before coming to Perth.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. It is tiring, but it's it's an adventure.
It's worth
Yeah.
it. I think that's great. Wow.
So
I
yeah,
wonder
plus the
where.
fact,
Go ahead.
plus I have an ulterior motive. We need sermon speakers here
Gotcha.
for the feast. So if you know anybody that's interested in coming to Australia, tell them to come to Rockingham because we really could do some extra help.
Wow.
So we'll get the
Okay.
word out here.
You bet.
Get the word out. Yeah.
Yep.
And
Now.
we'll look after them and treat them like royalty.
Oh, my.
And with the added money, they'll be royalty.
They will.
They'll be royalty.
They'll have
Yeah.
these
Plus they.
treasures. Yeah.
Yeah, plus they get to see, Australian wildlife and
Yep.
different things, so but
You
yeah.
do have kangaroos over there?
Yes, we have a wildlife park here in Perth where you can actually go feed them.
Oh my.
Yeah. Hold a
Koala,
koala.
koala.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay,
Well,
well,
thank you for sharing.
yeah, appreciate that a lot.
Yeah.
Phil, I'm leaving this in your hands here, but because I don't have any more to go. You know, I did have, we only have 6 minutes left. I did in my summary, I quoted some scriptures from Job, which fits with Esther, but maybe I can bring that in a little bit later.
You could bring it in at the beginning of the next
Yeah.
Bible study next Tuesday.
Yeah. Because in Job 5, it's really interesting and very encouraging and inspiring about what God did with Esther and what he can do with us.
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay, gang.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Have a great evening and a great week and a great Sabbath.
You too.
Yeah. He's still there, Philip?
Tim.
Yeah.
How are things, down under, mate?
I'm pretty busy, actually. We're a bit short-handed in the congregation here, so yeah, they keep me pretty busy.
It must be it's good. Winter down there.
Yeah, it's coming up. It's according to my computer, it's about 48 degrees Fahrenheit at the moment.
Oh, now I know why you have a sweater on.
That's what I was looking
yes.
at.
Yes. I've got a sweater on and the heater on.
Oh.
Oh, my dear. I didn't
know. Yeah. We can get some really cool nights. I think last night was about 7 Celsius, which would be 14, about high 30s.
Yeah. Ooh, that is cold.
Yeah.
Alan,
it is for Perth, because we're not used to it.
I just assume it was all balmy.
I
all
did
the
too.
Time.
That's a mistake.
No. It's the extremes. We go from this to the summer where you can get 110 degrees Fahrenheit or more.
Oh, wow. My. I had no idea.
So it's a big jump.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, it's what you get used to.
Yeah.
I used to smile when I was living there in Georgia.
Yeah.
And people were saying it's like 90 degrees Fahrenheit was hot. Because I think that you haven't seen nothing yet.
Yeah. You were thinking you got to go to Perth.
Yeah, you got to go to Perth. That's hot.
Yeah.
Now, the climate is really changing a lot. You know, we've had in the eastern states, we've had a lot of rain. Floods and all sorts.
Yeah.
And even in the center, Alice Springs, which is normally very warm.
Yeah.
Warm to, very hot. It's really cool there. It's only, around 60, which is very cold for the center of Australia.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the weather is, like you in America, the weather is crazy.
Yeah. Bob McCurdy just threw up in the chat room and it's $1,500 round trip to get to Perth from Atlanta.
Is so, that round trip?
Yeah, he's helping us.
$1,500. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought maybe they'd drop
that's
it to $1,500
American.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's economy. These days I only travel premium economy because my poor old knees can't hack economy anymore.
Yeah.
Is premium economy pretty nice?
It's just you get extra leg room and the seat goes back a bit further.
Oh, okay.
So the meals are the same.
Oh.
But when you get, when you've got bad knees, you need that extra leg space, especially when you're as tall as I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can't quite afford business class yet.
Yeah.
We're
40 seconds and it's going to turn us off.
Okay.
So with that,
give my regards to everybody.
You got a deal and I'll say good morning to you.
Yeah. Okay.
Have a waffle on me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good to see you guys.
Catch you again sometime.
Yep. Glad to have you on.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for livening it up a little.
Yeah.
See you guys.
Okay.
Bye, guys. Take care. Appreciate it. Love you. Bye.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.